The guardship trembled as metal creaked all around us and more water poured in. I grabbed Rax and sloshed through the water already up to my ankles. After exiting the chamber, I sealed the hatch, stopping any water from following us.
"You see?"
Rax told me as I hurried to the transfer chamber. "What do you mean, you see? You're not saying this is my fault. I just saved our butts. The cobalt bomb would have killed us if it had gone off inside the ship."
"That is incorrect,"
Rax said.
"You created the problem by flushing the corpse. The greater pressure created by the water activated the stomach device. You nearly killed us with your hasty action. You may have cost us the guardship as well."
I made a detour and hurried to my chamber as I shoved gear into a backpack. I couldn't believe this. What had I done? What had whoever had sent the clone director been thinking? I wanted to kill that person. But I couldn't worry about that now. The ship continued to groan all around me as it sank deeper into the ocean.
"Logan, we don't have any more time to..."
A sudden clang and a thud throughout the ship threw me off my feet, interrupting the crystal's complaints. "What just happened?" I said as I got up.
"The ship hit a ledge of sorts. It has stopped sinking for the moment."
"That's great."
"Yes, as I can still transfer us from here. But that will only work as long as the ship's battery power lasts. The engine room and the piloting chamber are flooded."
Rage consumed me. I shook my head. That wasn't going to help. I had to think, to figure this out. I was devastated at the thought of possibly losing the guard ship forever. "Okay," I said. "That means... well, it means we have limited teleportation for a time."
"That is bad, Logan."
I already knew that. I didn't need Rax hectoring me about it. I had to reframe this or I was going to start getting furious again and that would just waste time. "Turn it around," I managed to say. "We could have died just now. The breach could have let in the entire ocean at once. The guardship could be sinking, so we'd be too deep to get out. We're alive. We still have something, as we have teleportation, at least for a time. It may be enough to defeat Baran and his beast men. Sure. Given enough time, I'll get a sub and come and fix what happened here."
"That is far too optimistic."
I couldn't listen to his negativity, and arguing here was just dumb. I finished stuffing my pack, shouldered it, and rushed to the transfer chamber. It struck me then that I didn't know where we should go. CAU headquarters was in Utah at the Bonneville Salt Flats deep underground. The flats stretched for miles upon miles of white salt between the Great Salt Lake and the eastern Nevada state line. I'd been there on one other occasion. I'd gone with Kaz to rescue his friend Philemon, a 100-pound Homo habilis. Each of them used to work for the Star Corps and had come to Earth a long time ago. As I said earlier, Philemon was dead, killed in a strange Twilight Zone dimension. We'd used a rip in reality at the Bermuda Triangle to reach the place. Kaz had been at the Hera's hotel tower. How had he known about Baran and his battle thralls? Was Kaz still alive? Why had he tried to save Debbie and me?
"Should we call CAU?"
Rax asked, interrupting my thoughts. "And if we're right about Baran having taken over the facility?" I asked.
"We can help confirm that is true or not by calling."
"We could also give the game away by calling," I said. "Baran might be able to pinpoint the location of the guard ship if we call."
"We are working with too many assumptions and not enough facts,"
Rax said. "Are you proposing we transfer directly into CAU headquarters?"
"Now that you say it, yes, that is my suggestion. It is near the limit of where I can transfer us, though."
I considered the idea, soon shaking my head. "Seems like the place would be under the tightest surveillance one way or another," I said. "Security showed up pretty fast last time I broke in with Kaz." I eyed the crystal. "Unless you have some stealth gear stashed aboard ship that you're not telling me about." Rax did not reply. "So what is it?" I asked. "Do you have stealth gear?"
"No, but I could possibly short-circuit their surveillance system."
"How?"
"You could take an EMP grenade along. Once inside, you toss the grenade. The pulse will knock out their surveillance system."
"Wouldn't the pulse knock out more than that?" I asked.
"It would,"
Rax admitted. "I don't want a hammer to swat a fly. If CAU is still intact, we need their help against Baran."
"Perhaps if you appeared in the main surveillance chamber,"
Rax said,
"you could directly shut off the system."
"Do you know where the main chamber is?"
"I do not,"
Rax said. "So how does that help me?" I said, my voice rising.
"That is why I suggest you call first,"
Rax said.
"Maybe we could transfer whoever answers and interrogate them here. The air supply will last you for some time here."
I nodded. I liked it. "Set up a connection," I said. A few seconds passed. The comm screen in the transfer chamber began to blink. Someone began to appear on the screen, then the screen went snowy.
Someone is jamming our signal,
Rax said.
It is just like the jamming at Friday's station.
That proved Baran had done or was doing something to CAU headquarters. Baran was also my best link to getting Debbie back. This could be my only chance at getting a line on the Dominie. Listen, I said, transfer me to just outside the jamming range.
Do you mean above ground?
Yeah.
Ah,
Rax said.
I have found a hidden location. At least, I think it is hidden.
Then let's get started, I said. Chapter 10. I lay on hot white salt, using binoculars to peer over the lip of a depression. This was Rax's great hiding spot. A hot breeze blew over me. The breeze wasn't strong enough to kick up salt particles, but the day was so hot that the images in my binocular wavered and blurred. With a twist of my thumb, I refocused, trying to get a better image. It was hard to be certain, but I thought I saw several floaters, I decided to call them. Each was the size of a semi-trailer, and they hovered several feet off the white surface. Beastmen moved like ants from an underground entrance, pushing huge, hovering carts. The wolfmen walked the loaded carts up a ramp and into one or another of the floaters. Some returned down the ramp into the underground entrance of CAU headquarters, no doubt to collect more stuff.
What do you see?
Rax asked from my back pocket. I described the floaters and the U-Haul beastmen.
We must get closer,
Rax said.
From here, I cannot scan through the jamming. If I were closer, I might be able to bore through a concentrated scanning sweep. That might give us greater data.
Using the binoculars, I studied the situation with the idea of sneaking closer. Unfortunately, this was one of the flattest places on Earth. That was why automobile racers had used the Bonneville Salt Flats to set speed records. We'd been lucky to find this depression, but then we were on the edge of the flats. Mountains rose up behind me. What is it? I asked. Close to 6:30?
You cannot wait for dark. Surely they will leave before then.
Can you transfer me closer? I asked.
Possibly a little,
Rax said, sounding reluctant.
If the jamming signal should suddenly strengthen, widening the affected area, that could interfere with a successful teleportation and possibly result in our grisly deaths.
They'll spot me if I try crawling.
True,
Rax said.
Something has been bothering me about the timing of all this, and I finally realize what it is.
Yeah, I said, lowering the binoculars. The clone director answered my call only a short time ago. CAU must have been under siege then. Why didn't he say anything about it?
Precisely,
Rax said.
The other question is this. How did Lord Baran gain his information about you? We thought he got it from the CAU, but that cannot be correct if he hasn't already stormed headquarters.
Maybe he raided the CAU offices in D.C. and got preliminary data from those records and or the people there.
That strikes me as illogical,
Rax said.
If beastmen suddenly appeared in D.C., the entire nation should be in an uproar.
Maybe Baran hit those offices with greater finesse than he did Friday's station.
I deem that as unlikely, given his actions at Friday's station.
Yeah, that wasn't too subtle, was it? If he's so superior, why isn't he using superior tactics? Openly storming a place like Hera's with beastmen, he's advertising his presence, his extraterrestrial nature.
The reason for such bluntness might be arrogance,
Rax said.
Perhaps he considers the aboriginals of this planet inferior in quality. Thus, he believes he can act in a rougher or more lordly fashion.
Scowling, I said, I'm getting sick of aliens thinking they can push us Earthmen around.
To the contrary,
Rax said.
It is excellent that they think so. It has allowed us to maneuver inside their arrogance. If they had acted with greater caution each time, it is doubtful we could have won the various encounters as we did.
I picked up the binoculars and continued studying the beastmen and floaters. I didn't see any sign of Baran or other Antares Dominies. I watched for another 15 minutes as the beastmen kept filling up the alien U-Hauls. At the end of that time, the beastmen herded 50 or so people out of CAU and onto the floaters. All of the people were handcuffed as I'd been in Friday's station. I couldn't tell the identities of any of the individuals, just that they were human. Finally, beastmen shoved the ramps into the floaters and climbed aboard. I expected to see them race away. Instead, the floaters shimmered for several seconds and then disappeared. Did you see that? I said.
I scanned the situation at the last second,
Rax replied.
The jamming quit, allowing me to use my internal sensors. They transferred.
I can see that.
You did not let me finish,
Rax said.
They transferred off-planet.
How do you know that?
I scanned the direction of the transfer signal. It flashed off-planet.
To a waiting spaceship? I asked.
I do not think so. The signal was strong and continued past my scanning range. Of course, if I'd been in the guard ship, I could have followed the signal farther.
Where do you think they transferred?
The moon would be my guess,
Rax said. You're kidding.
I have no reason to hoodwink you.
But that's incredible. Do you think Baran or his people have a base on the moon?
That seems likely.
Wouldn't NASA or someone see that from Earth?
That is an interesting question. It would seem this theoretical base has remained hidden so far, yet the clone director knew about radio signals from Saturn. The question raises itself. Where did these signals travel? Were they aimed at the moon? Did the aliens radio anyone? Or were those transfer signals that the clone director detected?
This is all twisted up, I said. CAU had to be under assault when I called, yet the clone acted as if nothing was the matter there.
Perhaps we should investigate the premises.
Is anyone down there? Rax did not reply right away.
Yes,
he finally said.
I sent several people. Logan, danger! There is...
Before Rax could finish, a fantastic explosion erupted. Half a mile away or more, salt and dirt roared upward in a vast geyser as the ground shook under me. A shockwave must have been traveling at us. But it never struck me. I staggered in an upright position near Harris Hotel Tower in South Lake Tahoe. Rax must have transferred us just before the shockwave hit. Why are we here, exactly? I whispered.
I used an emergency transfer,
Rax said quietly.
Hatters was in my processor. I adjusted it at the last second, appearing down here on the surface instead of up at Friday Station on the 18th floor.
There were ambulances, cop cars, and fire trucks galore. Some of the cops had already set up their yellow tape. Crowds had gathered. Some of those people were near me. I saw a woman giving me the stink eye. Had she seen me teleport into existence? I gave her a nod before moving along, plunging into a crowd. Is she still watching us? I asked.
I do not know who you are referring to,
Rax said. I glanced back. The woman was no longer watching me as I'd moved too deeply into a crowd of gawkers, and she had plenty else to snag her attention. I kept pushing my way toward the rear of the crowd. It helped that as soon as people looked at me, they moved out of my way. Then it struck me that maybe that wasn't so good. I was likely memorable. I began dusting salt and dirt from my clothes. I wore a heavy backpack, must have looked beat up, and was probably grimy. I needed to get cleaned up. I also needed to catch my breath and figure out the next move. I glanced around and headed toward a restaurant several blocks away. I heard hurried footsteps behind me and began to turn.
Keep moving,
she snapped. I felt something hard press against my side. It felt like the end of a gun. I realized then that the voice had sounded familiar. I began to turn.
Don't,
she said. I did it anyway, seeing Jenna Jones of the CAU with a snub-nosed 38 pressed against my side. Chapter 11.
I told you not to look back,
Jenna said, digging the end of the barrel into my flesh. Hey, I said, that's smarts. Before she could react, I twisted around and grabbed the 38. She tried to hang on, but she didn't have any luck, as I was far stronger than she was. Jenna cried out, yanking her hand from the gun. She sucked on the finger that had been twisted by the trigger guard.
Are you an idiot?
She half shouted.
I could have accidentally fired the gun. That might have wounded you. It certainly would have brought the police running.
So why did you stick the gun in my side?
Give it back,
she demanded, holding out her unhurt hand. I studied Jenna. She wore an orange baseball cap with a mane of long dark hair spilling out from under it. She was tall, with blue eyes, a face to launch a thousand marriage proposals, and a statuesque figure. In other words, she was a babe, but she was tough and threw herself far too seriously into her work as a CAU field agent. If I hadn't been attached to Debbie a year ago, I handed Jenna the 38.
Thanks for nothing,
she said, shoving the snub-nosed into the shoulder holster under her windbreaker. So, I said.
Go,
she said, shoving me.
Keep walking. It's better if we don't stay out here.
I complied, continuing for the restaurant. Well, I asked as Jenna moved up beside me.
What's in the backpack?
She asked.
It looks heavy.
Never mind about the pack, I said. Why are you here?
Where should I be?
At CAU headquarters, I said.
What's that supposed to mean? I'm a field agent, which means I should be out in the field.
I looked in her eyes. The good book said to be careful when looking into a woman's eyes. They can trap a man with sexual temptation. Jenna's eyes certainly were beautiful. I'd been attracted to her before.
You never change,
she said, breaking the connection by glancing away. I raised an eyebrow, but I wasted the suave gesture because she wasn't looking at me. Are you hungry? I asked. She looked at me again, perhaps divining my destination, and shrugged.
I guess so. I haven't eaten since last night. Are you buying?
Why not? I said. Soon enough, we slid into a booth. I'd taken off the pack and slid it into the booth ahead of me.
What's in it?
She asked again. Her focus on my backpack didn't hit me as out of sync until subsequent events had transpired. Stuff, I said.
Where's Rax?
Around, I said, picking up the menu, scanning it. She pulled down the menu to stare at me.
What happened up at Harris?
How should I know?
People saw someone fall from the 18th floor, Jenna said. I've spoken to a few of those people. Those that watched this person said he simply vanished before hitting the pavement. There's only one man on Earth who can do that, and that's you.
Oh?
No, not oh,
she said.
A score of people were murdered in Friday's station. A few shocked survivors are reporting werewolves firing laser rifles. That's crazy, of course. The police are baffled as to what actually happened.
You talked to the police?
To the lieutenant in charge of the operation, she said. Luckily, the lieutenant is more worried about keeping this from the news and having it turn into Tahoe's Vegas shootout than coming to the obvious conclusion.
That aliens are involved? I asked. Jenna kept her hand on the menu as she scowled at me. There's more? I asked.
What's that mean?
I'm the one asking you, I said.
No,
she said.
I'm asking you what happened at Friday Station. You were up there, obviously. You jumped through a window, fell, and Rack saved your butt by teleporting you to safety.
I studied Jenna more carefully. I believed that her anger was genuine. But was this the real Jenna Jones, or was she another CAU clone? The waitress showed up, asking if we were ready to order. Jenna studied her menu and made a quick selection, and I did the same. The waitress returned almost immediately with our waters with lemon slices. I drained my glass and asked for a refill. Jenna shoved hers over to me and asked the waitress for another glass. I drained that water, too. Soon, Jenna had a new glass while I had two refills. I drank the one and held the last in reserve.
Why so thirsty?
Jenna asked as the waitress walked away. I glanced around to see if anyone was eavesdropping. It didn't seem like it. No one was in the booths on either side of us. Even so, I leaned across the table and kept my voice low. I have some bad news, Jenna. Her immediate frown drew a vertical line between her eyebrows. I gave her a quick rundown about Friday's station, the clone director dead in the ocean, and what I'd seen at the salt flats, including the fantastic explosion that must have demolished CAU headquarters. By the end, Jenna slumped back against her couch. She was pale, obviously shocked, and she struggled to hold back tears.
An explosion,
she whispered. I nodded in a sympathetic manner.
CAU is destroyed?
She asked. I don't know the extent. Rax took me out of there in an emergency transfer.
To here?
She asked. I nodded, and I realized I still trusted Jenna. Her grief was too sincere to be fake. Although she was pale, Jenna was frowning again, staring down at her hands. Finally, she began to shake her head. She looked up at me in accusation.
Your story doesn't hold together. The time sequences are wrong.
I agree, I said. Her scowl intensified.
Don't give me your diversion crap, she said. You're giving me a tall tale.
I'm not. But before we go on, I want to know who ordered the cloning of the director and how CAU matured the clone so quickly.
I have an observation to make,
Rax said from my pocket. I reached back and brought Rax onto the table, placing him near my full glass of water.
Hello, Jenna,
Rax said. She stared at the cell phone-like object, finally muttering a greeting.
The time sequence is off,
Rax said.
That would mesh, however, with the clone's advanced age.
Right, I said. You're talking about the chrono warp.
I am,
Rax said.
That is the only method I know that could account for the adult clone. The chrono warp must have sped up time in a concentrated bubble around the clone, aging it to maturity.
Jenna glanced from Rax to me. You didn't know about the clone? I asked.
No,
she said. Rax? I asked.
By all bodily indications,
the crystal said,
Jenna is telling the truth. Hey,
she said, sitting up indignantly.
Is Rax acting like a lie detector?
You passed, I said, so why worry about it? She drummed her fingers on the table. The food arrived, interrupting the conversation, and she appeared to relax. Jenna had a Caesar salad. I ate a bacon burger that was heart-stoppingly good. I finished first, as usual, wiping my lips with a napkin and still feeling hungry. I ate the lonely pickle slice on my plate, flagged down the waitress, and ordered a side of fries. By this time, Jenna shoved her plate aside. She seemed to have been thinking while she ate. She now looked up at me.
I've been trailing Kaz,
she said.
The director had grown interested in the Neanderthal again. Until the new orders, I hadn't seen Kaz since the Bermuda Triangle, when we all returned to Earth. The director said there were some bizarre stories piling up surrounding someone who could only be Kaz. I almost talked to Kaz several times, but he always gave me the slip. I knew he'd come to South Lake Tahoe.
Jenna lowered her voice.
Why did Kaz show up when he did? Why did he try to save your life in Friday Station?
Exactly, I said. I'd like to know that, too.
You claim to have no idea?
She asked. I spread my hands.
Are you not saying anything so you don't have to lie to me?
She asked. I don't know, I said. This whole thing baffles me. I want to know where this Antares Domini Baran took Debbie. Do the aliens have a moon base? If they do, why haven't we seen it? Why did the clone director talk about radio signals from Saturn?
I know CAU has detected that,
Jenna said.
The signals have been intermittent. It first began 2 months ago.
Oh, I said. So the clone wasn't lying about that?
I still find it hard to believe there was a clone,
Jenna said.
Do you realize how many complexities the idea of CAU clones raises? For instance, let's say for the sake of argument there are clones. How did the clone director become a midlife adult in a year? And if Rax's idea of the chronowarp is right, how did the clone learn what the director knows? Why didn't I know about this clone? How did the... I am certain the chronowarp is the key to all this,
Rax piped in, interrupting her litany.
Do you happen to know the location of the ancient device?
Jenna opened her mouth as if to say. She stopped suddenly. Her eyes grew wide and wary. I thought I detected fear in her bearing. I'm not going to do anything to you, I said. If you feel that you have to run away from me, go ahead. Run. Jenna's head came up sharply as she focused on me with hyper-alertness.
Why did you just say that?
She asked. You just figured something out, I said. Whatever it was scared you and made you wonder about me. Oh, I said after a moment. She was watching me closer than ever. You wonder if I'm me, I said. She hesitated before nodding in agreement. You're thinking what? I asked. That I'm an alien in a Logan disguise? Her hands had slid under the table. I had the feeling she was aiming the .38 at my midsection.
If I fire,
she said, confirming my suspicion,
and you live, I'll know you're an alien. If I fire and you die, I'll know I was wrong.
How does that help? I said. I could actually feel the pistol pointed at my gut, and I didn't like it one bit.
I'm going to ask you this once,
she said.
You said your guard ship took a hit. A hit from the... what did you call it?
A double helix cobalt bomb, I said. Have you ever heard of it?
Never.
Rax? I asked. The crystal was silent. I reached for him.
Don't touch it,
Jenna said. I frowned at her. What's going on now? She hesitated again before saying,
I'm trying to verify the truth.
Why don't you want me touching Rax? And why isn't he answering?
Let's stick to the issue,
Jenna said.
You always dodge a question you don't want to answer. Do you know that about yourself?
This turn in the conversation was starting to strike me as seriously off. What was wrong with her?
Your guard ship,
she prodded.
You said it sank.
Yeah, that's right. Jenna moistened her lips with the tip of her tongue. It was a pretty gesture, and those were pretty lips, even more so with a gloss of wetness.
Where did the ship sink, exactly?
Jenna asked. How does my answering that make any difference to you?
Just tell me,
she said. Well, a shot rang out, a single and unmistakable sound. For just a second, I thought Jenna had pulled the trigger. I winced, but didn't feel any pain. I did see her head disintegrate before me. It was as ugly a thing as I've ever seen. Blood jetted from the head wound, and she toppled sideways in the booth. People began screaming. Some jumped up and raced for the exit. As they did, a shadow loomed beside me. I was stunned by the latest event. I might have become a little woozy at watching Jenna die. A thick-necked man reached over to Jenna's corpse and grabbed her. It seemed like an obscene thing to do. He yanked her upright, reached inside her windbreaker, and took out a blinking green device. He examined it and seemed to find what he was looking for. He clicked the device.
Logan,
Rax said immediately,
I have detected a control device inside Jenna's brain.
What? I said, my lips feeling numb, my entire face feeling cold. A strong hand grabbed me, shaking me until my head wobbled.
Snap out of it, man, Kaz said. If you can, transfer us out of here.
I looked up at the Neanderthal's wide face with its bony ridge for eyebrows. He wore the same silky business suit as when he'd been in Friday's station.
Kaz? I asked.
Rax, the Neanderthal said. Get us out of here.
Hold it, a cop said from the door. Put your hands in the air or I'll fire. At that point, we transferred. Kaz, Jenna's corpse, Rax, and I.
Chapter 12.
We reappeared at the Utah salt flats near the base of the mountains. In the distance, there was a big hole in the salt pan with smoke still rising from it. Much of the area around the hole was dark with dirt and other debris. No one had arrived. I would have been surprised if anyone had gotten here so quickly. Jenna's corpse lay on the ground with blood still leaking from the broken skull. Kaz stood nearby with a .357 Magnum gripped in his wide left hand. I sat down hard on the ground. I was taking Jenna's death badly. It occurred to me what Rax had said just before the cops showed up. Jenna had had a control device in her brain. Rax, that device in her brain.
It is an exact copy of the device in Sergei's brain,
the crystal said. I know I've mentioned Sergei a time or two. He'd been a Ukrainian mobster under Hap's control. His full name had been Sergei Gromyko. Hap had possessed several clones of Sergei with a control device in each. The alien had been using the Ukrainian mafia for his nefarious ends. Are you saying our Jenna was another clone? I asked Rax. I could feel Kaz turn to stare at me. The Neanderthal had been studying the crater out there.
I do not know that,
Rax said.
It is difficult to tell a clone from the original. Perhaps Kaz has information that will help shed light on the problem.
I looked up at Kaz and noticed that he hadn't put the .357 away. The Neanderthal didn't aim the Magnum at me, but kept the gun down by his left leg. Kaz didn't say a word, though, just watched me. Maybe he was giving me time to get my bearings. I finally realized I was sitting on the ground. I stood and realized that Rax had also transferred my backpack with us. I debated shouldering the pack and finally did so, clicking the belt closed around my waist. Well, I finally asked. Kaz still did not say anything. Are you gonna shoot me next? I asked, indicating his gun. Kaz raised the gun to look at it as if noticing that he hadn't put it away. A wry smile twisted his lips. He flicked the cylinder out, extracted the spent shell, and put in a new one. Then he shoved the big gun into a shoulder rig holster, snapping a strap around the handle.
Long time,
he said, sticking out his meaty right paw. I was reluctant to shake that hand. He'd just murdered Jenna. But he had tried to save Debbie and me earlier today at Friday's station. In the end, I shook his hand, expecting anything, tensing as he began to squeeze. I half expected him to try a throw. Instead, Kaz released my hand and turned back to the crater out there. He pointed at it.
What do you think happened?
Kaz asked. I don't think, I said. I know. I saw it. He glanced at me. The Beastmen were here, I said.
Beastmen?
He asked.
Oh, you mean the furry men?
I think of them as wolf men, I said.
They're tusks,
Kaz said abruptly. You know where they're from? I asked. Kaz nodded.
The tusks are from the planet Kasser in the Antares system. Kasser is the third planet in the system. The Antares Institute is on the second planet, Seleucia.
How in the world do you know all that? I asked.
I know a lot of things, Kaz said, including that Lord Baran is hunting for you.
Okay, so how did you know Baran was going to be at Friday's station?
I didn't know, Kaz said, but it seemed like a good possibility, so I got into position just in case, and I ended up being right.
How did you know I'd go there?
I saw you hesitate on the 18th floor, he said. You thought about going to the buffet, but finally turned to Friday's station.
He was right about that. I debated going to the buffet as it was especially good, but had finally decided on the prime rib and window view of Lake Tahoe. I hadn't seen him trailing me, and that was surprising. Kaz should have stuck out like a sore thumb, him being a Neanderthal and all. "How long have you been following me?" I asked. Kaz shook his head. "What's that mean?" I asked.
"I haven't been following you at all," he said.
That didn't make sense, unless...
"You've been watching me?" I countered.
"That I have," he said, grinning. "For about a week, although I wasn't able to see you all the time."
"Okay, how have you been watching me?"
Kaz's grin widened, exposing his horse-like teeth.
"There's a lot you don't know, Logan. Of course, there are some things I don't know either. I did know about the clones, though."
Kaz pointed at Jenna's corpse.
"You can bet your sweet life that she was a clone. The clone wasn't evil, but she worked for the director, the real one, the one now on the run from Beran."
I stared at Kaz. Too much was happening too fast. I'd lost Debbie, I'd almost lost the guard ship, might still lose it, in fact. I'd watched CAU headquarters explode. I'd seen Jenna gunned down before me while talking to her in a restaurant booth. I massaged my forehead. It occurred to me that Rax had fallen strangely silent again. I recalled the device Kaz had switched off that had been in Jenna's possession. The crystal had immediately communicated after that. Could Kaz have switched the device back on? And if he had done that, why? I slid the backpack from my shoulders so it thumped to the ground. Then I began to walk toward the mountains. I didn't say anything, just needing to move my legs and do some thinking. I didn't even bother to test my theory about Rax just yet. Kaz knew too much. He obviously had access to some seriously interesting technology. Where could he have gotten such advanced equipment? I turned back, seeing that he'd turned to study the crater out there. Slowly, I retraced my steps, returning to my backpack. Kaz faced me.
"Feeling a bit better?" he asked.
I pointed at Jenna's corpse. "Why did you kill her? Was that really necessary?"
"Clones are an abomination," Kaz said.
"What?" I asked, surprised by that.
"You heard me."
I stared at Kaz in shock. "How long have you felt that way?" His eyes narrowed. I got the feeling he didn't like the last question. "Why isn't Rax talking?" I asked. Kaz's Neanderthal face stiffened. We must have both come to the same conclusion at the same instant as we each raced to draw our gun. Kaz moved fast, I moved faster. "Stop!" I shouted with my blaster aimed at his torso. His .357 was half drawn from his shoulder rig. He might have continued pulling it out. I would have pulled the trigger and gunned him down right there, though. I took 3 steps back. Reaction times were tricky things. A man could lunge at another and tackle him before the other man realized he needed to pull the trigger. And from the brain to the finger took time, too, during which the attacker is upon you. "Let go of the handle," I said. He did. "Using your thumb and index finger, draw the gun out of the holster and let it drop to the ground."
"This is a mistake," Kaz told me. "We don't have time for this."
"Do it," I said, "or I'll kill you here and now."
"I tried to save your life in Friday's station."
"Maybe," I said. "Maybe you're doing something else. I don't know. But if you don't disarm, I'm going to kill you, Kaz. I'm going to do it as cold-bloodedly as you murdered Jenna."
"That was a clone."
"Yeah, maybe, I don't know. I also don't know why Rax isn't talking." Slowly, Kaz did as ordered, letting the heavy .357 thud onto the dirt. "Back away from it," I said. He did, watching me closely the whole time. "Now sit down," I said. I did not motion with the blaster. That was always a stupid idea. Instead, I kept myself on hair trigger alert, pinpoint aim. He crouched like a primitive, remaining on his feet. "No, sit down," I said. Finally, he sat on the ground. I backed up 2 more steps.
"Why are you so paranoid?" he asked.
"Nothing worse than a frightened man acting to save his life," I said. "I'll do what I have to do in order to get Debbie back. You're my ticket to doing that."
"I'd like to help you."
"Shut up for a minute," I said. "I need to think this through." Kaz closed his mouth, watching me the entire time. I had the feeling he was waiting for a chance to jump me and reverse our positions. "How did you watch me?" I asked. Kaz stared up at the cloudless sky. He seemed to be debating with himself. Finally, he shook his head.
We can do this the hard way, I said. First I'll beam off your right foot, then I'll beam off your left foot.
I helped you, Kaz said. Jenna would have taken you to the director.
Good, I said.
Not good, Kaz said. I think the director would have tortured you for information. He's gone mad, Logan. He messed around with Hap's tech and it did something to him. Why do you think he's shoving control devices into the clones' minds?
That is weird, I admitted. Why isn't Rax talking? Kaz sighed and reached into his jacket.
You'd better pull your hand out slowly, I warned. He did, pulling out a small device with a green light. I'd last seen it when he pulled it from inside Jenna's windbreaker. He flicked the switch with his thumb. The device flashed with a blinding light. It surprised me. I staggered backward and finally remembered to fire my blaster. The whine of the alien gun told me I'd fired the beam. I waved the gun back and forth so the beam would obliterate everything around me just in case I'd missed the first shot. Finally, my eyes stopped watering and I could see again. I stopped firing. Kaz was gone. So was my backpack, and so was Jenna's corpse.
Chapter 13.
What happened? I asked Rax. For a wild, heart-stopping moment, there was no answer, and I thought Kaz had taken my crystal entity as well.
Logan?
Rax asked suddenly.
You're here, I said breathlessly, my heart now making up for lost time.
Where else would I be?
I picked Rax up off the ground, dusting him off on my jacket. How are you feeling? I asked.
Disoriented,
Rax answered.
I'm having trouble functioning.
Do you know why?
No.
I told Rax about the device with the green light.
I do not recognize its description,
the crystal said.
Clearly it turns me off in some manner. Since I was unable to record the incident and there is nothing to analyze in its absence, I can only theorize.
Well, I said, what are your theories?
Perhaps we should move. What if Kaz makes a sudden reappearance?
Good idea, I said. Teleport us.
In this instance,
Rax said,
I suggest you walk.
You mean go into the CAU ruins?
Exactly,
Rax said. Are you detecting anything down there?
I am not detecting radiation or any other harmful rays,
Rax said.
Therefore, I believe a scouting expedition would be a wise idea. Who knows what the beastmen have overlooked?
They're called Tosks, I said.
I beg your pardon?
I started walking for the crater in the salt pan. It would be dark soon. I didn't have a flashlight or a regular cell phone. I suppose Rax might generate a light for a short time. Still, better to use the sunlight while we had it. Soon, salt crunched underfoot as I told Rax everything that Kaz had said and done.
His behavior is most puzzling,
Rax said after I'd finished.
Clearly he has advanced technology. It's possible the Star Corps left certain stores of items on the Earth.
I'd forgotten about the Star Corps. It had been a giant crystal entity. The crystals originally taken from Rax Prime. A Polarion had constructed the Star Corps, a half-insane crystal intelligence with delusions of godhood and enough cosmic power to give it a go. I'd destroyed the Star Corps and thus saved humanity and the galaxy from a tremendous amount of grief. As I'd said before, Kaz and Philemon had been servants of the ancient crystal entity. The Star Corps had been asleep for a long time in a side dimension in Nevada. The nuclear testing in the 50s had woken it back up. Why did Kaz shoot the Beastmen up at Friday's station? I asked. Rax avoided the question by saying,
Star Corps leftovers are only one possibility. It is also possible the Neanderthals stumbled upon ancient Polarion tech.
That's even worse, I said.
I would tend to agree. There is a third possibility. Kaz may be acting in concert with Lord Baran.
That doesn't make sense, I said. He killed Beastmen. And why would Baran have Kaz do that if the Dominee planned to take me prisoner in Friday's station?
You have a point,
Rax said.
Let us scratch the idea of Kaz being Baran's ally.
Did Kaz transfer just now?
What else?
Rax asked.
Maybe he stumbled upon another guard ship then.
I suppose we cannot say that is impossible,
Rax said.
But Galactic Guard records did not indicate another lost shuttle on Earth.
Fine, I'm out of ideas then.
Logan, I urge caution,
Rax said.
I am detecting a life form deep inside the destroyed complex.
I was about 30 feet from the edge of the crater. Someone is alive down there? I asked.
Yes. It is a female of your species. She has lost blood. I suggest you use haste.
Well, which is it? I asked. Be careful or be reckless. Rax didn't answer at once. Finally, he said,
Both.
Using the waning sunlight, I worked my way into the crater. There was twisted metal, broken rock, junk, and blood in places. The Tosks, if that was their real name, hadn't taken everyone. Some human corpses littered the way. Luckily, after 15 minutes, I found a flashlight. I had to climb over a barrier and roll aside chunks of masonry to get it. How much farther is this woman? I asked a half hour later. My flashlight was the only source of illumination. I had to crawl through some corridors to keep going. The bomb had done a job on the underground complex, but it hadn't buried it because there hadn't been enough dirt above to cave in and fill up the structure.
The Beastmen appear to lack expertise in demolition,
Rax said.
I suspect they believe the power of the explosive would be enough to finish the task.
Maybe they were under orders to do a half-assed job, or they were under a time crunch.
Careful, Logan. My sensors have just indicated... Down!
I hit the deck as a bullet whizzed overhead, ricocheting against the walls behind me. Why didn't you tell me...
Wait,
Rax whispered.
Let me compute this. Ah, an access tunnel. I don't know why I didn't perceive the side route. The person we have come to rescue had a clear field of fire through a small access tunnel. She is still some distance from us.
Do you recognize her?
No.
Hey, I shouted. Don't shoot. We're here to help. I waited for a reply. What do you sense? I whispered.
Nothing different,
Rax said. I cupped my hands around my mouth, rose up some, and shouted as loud as I could. I'm here to help. Don't fire. We can't rescue you if you kill us. There was no response. Fire twice if you agree to that, I shouted at her. Two shots went off. Great, I muttered. Do we trust her?
I would not,
Rax said.
This is a trick.
I clicked off the flashlight, got up, reached the access tunnel, and began to crawl through it. It was a tight fit. That plus the darkness made me claustrophobic.
The person is breathing erratically,
Rax said softly. I increased speed.
Stop,
Rax whispered.
I believe she senses us. She has a weapon and is sighting down the tube.
I made an instant decision. I flicked on the flashlight, beamed it on my face, and shouted, I'm Logan. I'm with a Galactic Guard. I'm here to help you. I heard a ragged gasp.
Logan?
She asked in a pain-filled voice. Yes. Who are you? There was no answer. I crawled faster, using the flashlight now. In less than 5 minutes, I reached an unconscious woman with long dark hair. Blood soaked her jacket and pants. I played the flashlight on her face. It was Jenna Jones of the CAU. Chapter 14. I had Rax transfer us to Turlock, California, a small mid-state city where I'd lived for a time growing up. I carried her into emergency at Emmanuel Hospital. I used fake IDs for both her and me. Jenna carried one on her person, and I'd long ago manufactured several for me. We had to wait to see the doctor. Emergency was filled with people, mainly Mexicans who had migrated to the States in the last 20 years and a few Middle Eastern people who had migrated in the last 2 years. It made me angry that Jenna had to wait as she did. Finally, a nurse showed up and they wheeled Jenna into a room. I waited, pacing and thinking, as they stitched her worst wounds, checked her condition, and gave her a blood transfusion. Rax, I whispered. Did you scan any devices in her brain?
I scanned earlier,
Rax said,
but her brain was devoid of any control equipment.
What about the rest of her? I asked.
Do you refer to bombs?
Anything out of the ordinary, I said.
Jenna had a handheld locator device while at CAU, but I did not transfer that with us.
What was the locator thingamajig for?
I believe she was watching our progress with it back in Utah. It was a mini-sensor, but one of alien manufacture.
From Hap's stolen stash? I asked.
I deem that most likely.
Hap didn't have any transfer tech, did he?
Not to my knowledge,
Rax said.
Sir?
A nurse said. I looked up, not having noticed the woman approach.
Your friend is asking for you,
the nurse said.
She seems to think it critical and is becoming rather insistent. Perhaps you can help calm her? She refuses any sedatives.
I'll see what I can do, I said.
If you'll come with me?
the nurse said. I followed her and soon entered a different room from before. Jenna lay in a bed. She had better color, wore a hospital gown, and stared at me intently as I entered. I could tell she wanted to say something, but hesitated in the nurse's presence. You have to take it easy, honey, I said, hurrying to Jenna's side. I put a hand on an arm, rubbing it. Jenna frowned for just a moment.
Can you tell us what happened, sir?
The nurse said.
Jenna claims she can't remember anything. She seems coherent enough, but...
I turned to the nurse. Came home, I began.
Home?
The nurse asked, interrupting.
According to what you told the desk clerk...
You know, I said, approaching the nurse, taking hold of a shoulder. I really need to see the doctor. Immediately, I added. The nurse looked uncomfortable. I removed my hand but gave her a knowing look. It's vital I speak to the doctor at once. The nurse seemed suspicious of me, finally nodding and going out the door.
I'll be right back, she said.
I whirled around as the door closed. How do you feel? I asked Jenna.
Groggy,
she said.
The last thing I remember is being in CAU headquarters. Everything went white, and that was it.
That's fine, I said. Are you well enough to move?
Just leave the hospital?
She asked. Right now, I said.
Won't they ask questions if we do that?
Rax will move us, I said. Jenna looked up at a monitor.
They'll see us transfer.
I took that to mean Jenna was well enough to move. We just had to set up the conditions first. I grabbed a chair, shoved it near the wall camera, stood on it, wrenched the video feed from the wall, and dropped the thing on the floor. Ready, Rax?
The ship's battery power is becoming dangerously low from these repeated transfers,
he said. Make it a short transfer then, I said.
The distance does not matter.
Fine, fine, I said. Take us back to the guard ship then. Maybe I can do something with the batteries.
I do not advise that,
Rax said.
The air content in the guard ship will not be good for long. He should take us to the ancient Polarian structure at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean,
Jenna said.
That is beyond my present transfer range,
Rax said.
We should decide now, though. The doctor is returning with the nurse.
Put us in a car lot, I said.
That is imprecise.
Outside the hospital in the parking lot, I snapped.
Logan?
Jenna warned. We transferred as the door began to open. I staggered outside in the Emmanuel parking lot near the emergency entrance. Jenna lay on the blacktop in her hospital gown. I glanced around and chose a blue Silverado pickup, a four-door. Rex, I said while holding him. The locks clicked open. I yanked open a rear door and helped Jenna inside. Slamming her door, I opened the driver's side and hopped in. The half-ton roared into life as Rex did his thing with the ignition. I didn't like stealing a man's truck, but this was an emergency. I would try to leave the truck in as fine a shape as I'd found it. Hopefully the man would get it back in a day or so. I drove out of the parking lot and headed north.
Now what?
Asked Jenna. Now, I said, we find a clothing store and get you something to wear. I have a few hundreds in my wallet.
That won't buy me much,
Jenna said. I glanced back as she lay across the rear seat. This isn't a shopping spree, I said. I just want to get you something other than that hospital gown.
Fine,
she said.
I'll need shoes, too, not these paper slippers.
I muttered something under my breath, looking around, trying to get my bearings. It had been more than a few years since I'd been in Turlock. Things looked bleak for us, as far as I could tell. I had a Jenna, hopefully the real one. My guard ship was wrecked off the coast, the battery power was dying, CAU headquarters was in shambles, an alien had abducted my woman, and Kaz seemed to be one of my many enemies. For all I knew, the hospital was giving my picture to local police and maybe the FBI. If that were true, it probably wouldn't take long for them to figure out who I was, as CAU would have a feed into the feds. Just what was this all about, anyway? And how could I get Debbie back? Chapter 15 Jenna and I ate at Panera's near Freeway 99. She was wearing new clothes and shoes that we'd bought at TJ Maxx in the shopping center across the street. Jenna slurped clam chowder out of a big bread bowl, having already devoured a turkey sandwich with apple slices in it. I drank coffee after downing a ham sandwich. The bacon burger before had been enough, but the smell of food had made me hungry again. Jenna had stitches along her left side and in her left thigh. They were bandaged, but she was moving gingerly and had gotten pale while trying on the clothes and shoes. The food had brought back her color. You holding up okay? I asked.
I'm fine,
she said tersely. You know I have a horde of questions, right?
So do I,
she said. I nodded, sipping more coffee, deciding on the best approach and if I could trust her or not. Any comments, Rex? I asked. The metal casing was near my left hand on the table.
I am going to assume your question means if this is the original Jenna or not,
the crystal said quietly.
I believe she is.
Jenna's head snapped up. I could see she had a question, but thought better of it and went back to eating her clam chowder. You know the director made clones, right? I asked her. Jenna nodded. Did you know he'd made a clone of you? I asked. Jenna shook her head. Did you suspect it? I asked.
I suppose,
she said quietly.
I didn't want to believe it, but the director kept getting more paranoid. It got really bad after we detected the signals from Saturn.
That happened 2 months ago? I asked.
You know about the Saturn-based signals?
It was my turn to nod.
What do you know?
Jenna asked. I took another sip of coffee and noticed the cup was empty. I got up, pumped myself more, added cream, and came back. Jenna had finished the chowder and had begun tearing apart her bread bowl, eating it. The girl had an appetite. That was a good sign. As I sipped my coffee, I told her everything that had happened since the Tosks showed up in Friday's station. I told her what her clone had said and what Kaz had related. Where do you think this Lord Baran took Debbie? I asked finally.
Behind the moon, for starters,
Jenna said. What's that mean?
The moon always faces the Earth with the same side,
Jenna said.
That's where the term the dark side of the moon comes from. If one side always faces Earth, the other side always faces out.
There's a name for that phenomenon, I said.
Of course there is. Tidal lock, for one.
She gave me her duh look.
The point, we believe, is that the moon base is on the dark side. The face directed toward Earth is just a staging area.
And? I asked.
We've detected a strong signal going from the back of the moon to Deimos.
Where in the heck is that? I asked.
Deimos is one of the two small moons of Mars.
Mars again, I said.
We've detected a signal leaving Deimos and heading for Ceres,
Jenna said. Ceres down the road? I asked, perplexed. From Turlock, going north, it went Keys, Ceres, and then Modesto.
Not that Ceres,
Jenna said,
but the asteroid or dwarf planet of Ceres. Astronomers are always changing the names and designations of various small stellar bodies,
Jenna said primly.
Ceres used to just be the largest asteroid in the asteroid belt. A few years ago, astronomers said that Ceres and Pluto were dwarf planets. Nothing changes, but those size designations of stellar bodies do.
Let me guess, I said. CAU has also detected signals going from Ceres to Saturn. Jenna shook her head.
From Ceres to one of Jupiter's moons, she said. From there, the signal goes to Saturn.
What does CAU believe those signals mean?
Transfer or teleportation signals,
Jenna said.
That is well reasoned,
Rax said, keeping his voice low.
Transfer signals from Saturn to Jupiter are just barely within the accepted limits of high-powered transfer rays.
Are you saying Debbie could be in the Saturn system? I asked. That she hopped from the moon to Mars to Ceres to Jupiter and finally to Saturn?
Maybe,
Jenna said. I sat back in disbelief. This was worse than I'd imagined. How do I get Debbie back? I asked.
That's only one of the problems,
Jenna said. I scowled thunderously.
Although clearly that is an important problem,
Jenna added hastily. I finished my coffee, debated drinking more, and finally decided against it. Another cup would have me trembling. I didn't feel like having a caffeine high just now. Should I tell her what you think is going on? I asked Rax.
Perhaps we should hear Jenna's side of the story first,
the crystal said. I put a hand on the table, focusing on Jenna. What is going on? I asked. Why did the director start making clones? Why did he have you, correction, have your clone follow Kaz? How did Kaz gain transfer technology? And if you know, what is Dominique Baran after here on Earth? Jenna looked away as she crumpled the remaining bread piece in her hands. Soon she began to nod. She looked at me with a tired smile.
Well,
she said,
it started like this.
Chapter 16.
Soon after the Bermuda Triangle Chronowarp incident, the CAU sent a team back to the Polarian structure at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean,
Jenna said.
The first party, oh, that was 11 months ago now, died, or we believe they died. No one returned after entering the underwater structure. The director ruled against making another attempt right away. The scientists studied the structure from submarines, but gained no further clues as to the structure's true nature. Finally, though...
Jenna became thoughtful as she stared at me in a distracted manner.
8 months ago, one of the underwater science vessels mysteriously exploded. The other fled, but not before launching several probes toward the structure. All but one of the probes also self-destructed. The last one...
Jenna refocused on me.
The last one recorded a black torpedo slashing toward the Polarian base. The torpedo did not detonate against the ancient structure, but slowed and finally maneuvered underneath it for the bottom water entrance. Just like we did over a year ago, the torpedo used the sea entrance and went up into the structure.
It wasn't a torpedo then, but a sub of some kind, I said.
That was the scientist's conclusion as well,
Jenna said.
Please, Logan, quit interrupting me. Let me tell the story all in one piece so I can remember everything.
I nodded, indicating that she should continue.
Where was I?
Jenna asked.
Oh, yes. The director demanded we learn who had crewed the black torpedo. Some of the scientists suggested it could be Polarians themselves. They proposed the idea that the Polarians secretly moved among us. Others pointed out that the torpedo's hull had been constructed of the same material as Hap's destroyed space plane.
Ah, I said.
The director decided that meant Kaz must have been in the torpedo.
Was he? I asked.
We still don't know,
Jenna said.
But if Kaz had gone inside the structure, it might explain how he's come upon transfer technology.
You think Kaz stole it from the Polarians? I asked. Jenna nodded. Then, I said. Jenna gave me a cross look before shrugging.
I'll make this brief, as I'm starting to feel sleepy. Your constant interrupting isn't helping.
I had to admit, at least to myself, that I was feeling the effects of a full day and could use some shut-eye myself. The coffee's caffeine didn't seem to have much kick.
7 days after the torpedo entered the ancient structure, it departed. The director was ready for that. 2 U.S. attack subs moved in to intercept. The torpedo fired tiny projectiles. Those projectiles destroyed the 2 subs.
And?
And that's all I know concerning the black torpedo-shaped craft. It got away. It might have been Kaz, but I don't know for sure.
Sketchy, I said.
I'm telling you what I know,
Jenna said, her voice rising. Several people from other tables glanced at us. Hey, I'm right here, I told Jenna.
Quit making me mad,
she said more quietly. Sure, I said. No problem. Is the fact of the torpedo destroying U.S. subs what drove the director over the edge?
That's an interesting question,
Jenna said after a thoughtful moment.
I kind of doubt it, but it did cause him to do something uncharacteristic. He went on a field mission. The director ordered another attempt to breach the Arctic Ocean structure. I didn't know about his involvement until later, but he came aboard at the last minute, and the director went over with the first and only team of operatives that went up into the structure in a bath escape like we did over a year ago.
I nodded. This was getting interesting.
The team never came out,
Jenna said.
The CAU submarine captain wanted to send a second bath escape. Orders soon arrived from headquarters to return immediately to base. Along the way, the submarine had a mysterious accident. There were no survivors.
But...
Let me finish,
Jenna said sternly.
There were no survivors, no black box, no explanation for the accident. What's even stranger was that the director had instructed his second-in-command to give the orders. The director did this from CAU headquarters.
Wait a minute, I said. You told me he went on the mission and entered the Polarian structure, the one that no one exited.
I fudged just a bit,
Jenna said.
I found a backup missive in the archives that said he went. The official records don't say anything about him leaving headquarters.
That one is going over my head, I said.
CAU has a special backup system for record keeping,
Jenna said.
Every once in a while, a copy of the logs goes to the archives. It's a special failsafe that...
You're saying the official records say the director never went to the Polarian base, and yet the archives said he did.
Right,
Jenna said. Then why did you say he went with the first team into the structure if he didn't go?
I think the archives are telling the truth. I think the director altered the regular logs but forgot about the archives. It was a chance thing that I looked at the archives. But once I saw that, other things began to come together. I suspect the last submarine was destroyed in order to cover his tracks. The captain, likely most of the crew, would have known the director went into the Polarian structure. The director couldn't afford anyone to know that, obviously. That was when his strange behavior started.
I thought about that. If the last submarine was deliberately destroyed, I said, do you think the black torpedo returned and picked up the director?
No, because other underwater sensor buoys kept watch around the ancient structure. No other vessel left or entered the place.